Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Eade, Judge Reyes, Judge Larson. The Honorable Keala Eade presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 6, 2024. We have three cases on our oral argument calendar this morning. A couple of housekeeping matters before we start. Counsel, as you're probably aware, when you approach the podium, there's a button on the front that allows you to raise it and lower it to your comfort level. These proceedings are being recorded. They're being live streamed on Zoom. The audio recording of them after the proceeding will be available within about 24 hours. That's the only recording of today's proceedings. Otherwise, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument on behalf of the appellant and 5 minutes for rebuttal and respondent. You will have 15 minutes and you'll see the time indicated in front of you. When you start your argument, please identify yourself, who you represent, and how you'd like us to refer to you. The first case on our calendar this morning is A23-1219, Jermaine Edward Harris, petitioner appellant versus State of Minnesota respondent. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tyler Bliss. I am an attorney on behalf of Jermaine Harris, the appellant. Mr. Harris is asking for a post-conviction hearing in this case where the key witness has recanted his testimony and has said he was pressured to do so and incentivized to do so by his party opponent, the state of Minnesota. The appellant was convicted at a third trial following two prior mistrials, where the primary difference between the first two and the third trial that resulted in the conviction was the testimony of the now recanting witness. The facts here are that Mr. Hill, the recanting witness, was the most direct apparent witness to this crime. Mr. Hill.
Is that true, though? There was a another percipient witness that testified at length to what he saw.
I believe that is true. However, I think that the best evidence that the juries didn't consider that was, while Mr. Jenkins' testimony was consistent in all three trials, the primary difference in the conviction was the testimony of Mr. Hill.
I mean, I think you meant Mr. Dixon, is that?
Yes, Mr. Dixon, sorry.
All right, well, because my understanding is one of the reasons why the court ruled in the way it did is it relied pretty heavily on the fact that Mr. Dixon's testimony was consistent and he did observe what happened, whereas even if credited, the affidavit indicates that Mr. Hill would have just slept through what occurred. Is that right?
I believe that if credited, he would have slept through it. However, he would not have witnessed it, which appears because the conviction happened when his testimony was different, was persuasive to the jury.
So, counsel, I do have a question on what basis your claim, what's the basis for your claim? In other words, you talk about the NAFLA bar, but it seems like you're actually more relying on the statutory bar under Minnesota Statute 590.01.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. I just want to clarify that. And you're not necessarily arguing that it wasn't time-barred. Your argument is more that two of the exceptions, the newly discovered evidence exception and the interest of justice exception, apply in this case.
That is correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Counsel, you didn't file a reply brief in this case. Do you concede the state's argument that you cited cases related to NAFLA as opposed to cases related to the time bar?
I do not.
And so how would you respond to the state's argument that they raised in their brief with regard to the...
Your Honor, I believe that we did raise issues related to the statutory bar, and I believe that it is... that our basis is largely that this was is under the newly discovered evidence exception.
So under the newly discovered evidence exception, under the statutory time bar, you have to, appellant has to show by clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner is actually innocent of the offense, not just, so that's a fairly high bar. How do you get to that bar if we have the testimony of Dixon, who said he saw appellant get out of the car, the gunshots, you know, he basically feared for his life. He appears to be a direct witness. How does, even if we were to assume, for the sake of argument, that appellant's testimony, he gave false testimony, there's still Dixon's testimony. So how can you show that he was actually innocent?
I believe that given the procedure prior to this, where there were two juries that hung on it, and then the third jury relying on Hill's testimony, felt that that was so key to their determination that it resulted in the conviction, I believe that it shows that he would actually be innocent of the crime, that the other testimony was simply not believable beyond a reasonable doubt.
But that's different than being innocent. Sorry.
Is the only evidence that you're pointing to for that the fact that the testimony was different, so you're assuming that the jury relied on that? Or is there something else in the record that would indicate that the jury somehow relied more heavily on Hill's testimony than Dixon's?
I don't think, because we don't have, you know, anything from the internal workings of the jury, we have that. I think that the implication of the three juries is what I can put forward.
And can you just explain, in the other trials, was Dixon's testimony exactly the same, substantially the same?
Substantially the same, Your Honor. In reviewing it, I believe they relied largely on his transcripts, but I think he also did testify. But in my recollection of review of them, they were very, very similar.
If Mr. Hill was allowed to testify in a fourth trial consistent with the affidavit, wouldn't that just be one more layer of impeachment? I mean, he clearly was impeached in the third trial based on the inconsistent statements between the initial investigation, what he said to the police, the grand jury testimony, and the first trial testimony. So why wouldn't this just be one more layer of impeachment?
I believe where there is government misconduct of pressuring a witness and then not disclosing to the defense, it could be characterized as impeachment, but it's strong enough impeachment that I think it could directly affect the result and could imply innocence.
But I think that, doesn't that tend to go towards Judge Reyes's question? Because this isn't that Mr. Hill would testify that Mr. Harris had an alibi and affirmatively wasn't present when it occurred. The difference is between him saying that he heard the shooting and what Mr. Harris said to him afterwards, I shot him, he shot me, or he shot me, I shot him, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, and I think that this is where there was some internal inconsistency even in the affidavit. Mr. Hill never said he saw Mr. Harris with a gun or actually saw the shooting. So the difference in the testimony slight, I think arguably slight, and doesn't necessarily go towards that actual innocence that Judge Reyes was asking you about. What's your response to that?
I think in this case, where there is very marginal testimony from all individuals who were, as Mr. Petras describes, were smoking wet sticks, which were PCP-coated, marijuana cigarettes, all of that testimony is deeply unreliable, and I think it goes to a theory of actual innocence and that none of this testimony can really be credited.
I I mean, that sounds a lot like reasonable doubt, perhaps, but in terms of clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Harris is innocent of the offenses in order to get around the time bar, I'm concerned that what you're arguing isn't sufficient. Can you address that?
I believe that in any of these cases, it's extraordinarily difficult to get to this, to meet this bar. However, we're not asking at this point for the new trial. We're asking for an evidentiary hearing on it. And I think that this is the sort of evidence that when you have an affidavit alleging this sort of prosecutorial misconduct, along with a recantation of the testimony, there is a reasonable likelihood that that testimony would result in proof of actual evidence or innocence, and I think that he deserves that hearing.
But even if we excluded, even if his testimony was excluded, or to your point, his testimony, he testified consistent with his affidavit that basically he was asleep, he didn't observe anything. We still have the testimony from Dixon, who said he saw Harris get out of the Explorer with a gun in his hand, fire at least 3 shots. He heard Jenkins yell when he was shot, and Dixon found Jenkins unconscious where he collapsed behind the Impala that they had been driving. So even putting aside all the testimony about, you know, what they were doing beforehand, that testimony seems to be enough to convict appellant.
That testimony was given to 2 separate juries, and neither of those juries convicted him.
But we don't. But to your point that you made earlier, we don't know what those juries were thinking, and that testimony alone seems to be enough to, be able to convict somebody. And maybe more to the point, isn't that contrary to the idea that he actually was innocent?
I think that when you are given the facts after, you know, in a transcript, it's very different than a jury hearing them. And I think that the actual innocence here is this testimony, I don't think, from him was credible twice. And I think the only credible testimony...
Oh, but we can't assume that. We can't answer that question in terms of credibility here. All we can go by is what testimony had been provided and then the affidavit. And that affidavit has to show actual innocence. In other words, if that affidavit said it wasn't appellant, it was actually somebody else who shot him, I saw another person, that potentially could be evidence of actual innocence, an alternate perpetrator. But that's not what we have here. We just have somebody who's saying, yeah, he never said, he shot me, so I shot him. And, that he didn't see the actual shooting.
And, Your Honor, I certainly understand the procedural posture here. However, I do think that the fact of it being a third trial is a substantially different fact pattern than just reading a single transcript and not having any sort of interpretive basis for how a jury had looked at this or whether a conviction could be sustained without this testimony. A conviction was unable to be sustained twice in a row without this testimony. This testimony was at the basis of the conviction, and I think that without that testimony, there's a strong likelihood of actual innocence here because, again, these are statements of people who'd been smoking PCP-laced cigarettes, and it is deeply suspect for the basis of a conviction.
Do you have any cases where an evidentiary hearing has been granted on the basis that there were 2 prior hung juries?
No, I have not found any in Minnesota case law.
And so we would really be creating new ground in terms of post-conviction relief to be looking at what happened in the past as opposed to what happened in this particular trial?
That is my belief.
Okay. My second question is, what is the evidence that you think, what would be the benefit of having an evidentiary hearing in this case? What is the additional evidence that you think could come in. What is it that you think an evidentiary hearing would develop in terms of this record that warrants a hearing? Because, you know, I think in this situation, we're just assuming the affidavit is true. And so how would an evidentiary hearing actually develop the record here in a meaningful way?
What we have is an affidavit that was produced in an uncounseled manner by a person in prison. I believe that having his testimony guided by counsel would enable us to more fully develop what he is alleging in regards to prosecutorial misconduct. I think it could then enable us to dig into such prosecutorial misconduct and then be able to look more solidly into the nature of any alleged misconduct. And I would cede my remaining 14 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Over 7 years have elapsed between when appellant's conviction became final in January 2016 and when he filed the post-conviction petition that's at issue in this appeal in February of 2023. I stand by my position that I put in my brief that based on appellant's brief, the only issue that has been raised on appeal to this court is whether the first four post-conviction claims that appellant raised in his post-conviction petition that pertain to James Hill's affidavit must be considered by the district court under the interest of justice exception to the statutory post-conviction time bar. Judge Cook did not abuse his discretion by determining that that specific exception, the interest of justice exception, did not warrant the consideration of those four James Hill-related claims. Judge Cook, on page 6 of his order denying the post-conviction petition, he quotes Hill's testimony at the third trial about the pressure that Hill felt and that he was under to cooperate with the state's prosecution of appellant. Those are transcript sites 1344 and 1439 of the trial transcript, again from the third trial. I'll return to that third trial transcript issue in a moment. And appellant argues, what I hear him arguing is that there was a secret plea agreement in which the state agreed to not charge Hill with murder in exchange for his testimony, but as this court's questions alluded to earlier, that's not what Hill actually says in his affidavit. I strongly encourage this court to read paragraphs 32, 34, and 36 on page 3 of Hill's affidavit. Hill does not claim that the prosecutors expressly told him, as a condition of a plea agreement, that the state could not charge Hill with murder. Rather, what Hill says is that he, quote, interpreted, end quote, the words, that if appellant did not get the time, I would get the time. He interpreted that as meaning that he would get charged with murder unless he had pled guilty and testified regarding what he had heard in the scene. There's simply no allegation in the one affidavit that we're trying to rely on in this case, the entire basis for those four post-conviction claims I referenced before, that either trial prosecutor in this case actually said, you will get charged with murder unless you plead guilty and testify regarding what you heard at the scene. Hill's own personal interpretation really is speculation, and that's not what the interest of justice exception to the time bar stands for and what it would allow in this case. Another thing that Judge Cook pointed out in his post-conviction order is that Hill affirmatively testified again at the third trial that he did not see appellant with a gun, page 1289 of the trial transcript, and he did not see appellant shoot anyone, page 1281 of the trial transcript. Again, all things that the jury actually heard when they were deciding whether or not appellant was guilty here. Page 1454 of the trial transcript is also worth noting because that is the page where Hill affirmatively testified that the state put pressure on him, but they put pressure on him in Hill's own words to tell the truth. I want to address a question that I heard Judge Larson ask earlier.
First, so in terms of that argument, which prongs of the Larison test do you think those arguments go to?
We don't need to get to the Larison test.
So you don't think we need to get to the Larison test at all?
I think the only issue that has been presented to this court in the briefing is whether or not those four post-conviction claims qualify under the fifth of exception to the post-conviction time bar, okay. That interest of justice exception.
Thank you.
Judge Larson, I heard you ask a question earlier to Mr. Bliss about the consistency of Dixon's testimony in the first trial and the second trial and the third trial. At least that, I thought I heard you ask that. Nobody can sit here today and say how consistent that was because there are no transcripts of Dixon's testimony from the first trial or from the second trial. That was in a separate court file. That was in court file 27CR12-38788. That was when the state had indicted appellant with first-degree murder. That was the case. That was the district court file in which those first two trials that resulted in a hung jury took place. The indictment was then dismissed by Judge Cook following the second hung jury, and the state then separately charged in the current district court file that this appeal emanates from, 27CR13-33511, and that is the only trial transcript that exists for this set of facts, the one that's in this case. If you go back to that other court file, there are four transcripts available in that other court file, and they're all from pretrial proceedings. So there is no indication in the record about how consistent Dixon's testimony was in the first trial and the second trial versus the third trial. And the reason that's relevant is because of all the weight that I hear being placed on the one difference between the trial being how Mr. Hill testified. We don't know how Dixon testified in the first trial or in the second trial. We only know how he testified in the third trial. The one continuity from those three trials is the trial judge, Judge Cook. And that's why this court should defer or at least place some emphasis on the repeated observations that Judge Cook made in his post-conviction order denying the post-conviction petition, in which he talked about how Dixon's testimony was so important and powerful, and really the parts that Hill actually testified to were just cumulative.
But isn't Mr. Bliss's point that we need to assume, or that even if you assume that Dixon testified substantially similar, I think was a term he used, across all three trials, the difference in the third trial is, you know, in the first trial, you have Mr. Hill essentially recanting. In the second trial, he refuses to testify. In the third trial, he finally testifies consistent with the grand jury testimony. And from Mr. Bliss's perspective, now we have suddenly a conviction. So what's your response to the emphasis he's asking us to place on the hung juries in the first two trials versus, you know, how that plays into the importance of Mr. Hill's testimony in securing a conviction in the third trial?
It would be a bold assumption to know what Dixon testified to in the first and second trial. I think that's the point. I heard before, and I don't want to misquote you, Judge Ead, but like substantially similar testimony was given with the exception of Mr. Hill. There's no indication in any record that the testimony from the first trial to the second trial to the third trial with respect to any of the witnesses was substantially similar or different with the exception of Mr. Hill. And so I guess if it was the point I was trying to make there was that Dixon's testimony is known in this particular trial, the third trial. It's not known in the first trial or the second trial. And Judge Ead, from having sat on the district court and presided over district court proceedings, juries can be hung and mistrials can be ordered for a wide range of reasons other than there not being an adequate amount of evidence or sufficient evidence. And I think that the fact that this case was repeatedly tried over and over again is because the prosecutors thought, upon talking with the jury, which often happens after a hung jury, as to what was missing or why the jury couldn't come to some sort of consensus, is that they thought that they still did have sufficient proof based on the evidence that they had been presenting in each of those trials, and that's why they continued to try.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. I want to put a finer point on this and not focus so much on Dixon's testimony, but Hill's testimony or the lack thereof. Specifically in the second trial, Hill did not testify at all, and it resulted in a hung jury. He testified in the third trial, and the state obtained a conviction. Doesn't that seem to indicate the importance of Hill's testimony, focusing on Hill's testimony?
It contributed to the guilty verdict. I think it would be disingenuous to suggest otherwise. But I think we need to look at what Hill actually testified to and what this court in its previous decision in appellant's direct appeal characterized that testimony, which is cumulative to Dixon's testimony. I think I heard Judge Ede pointing out before the differences between, again, I'll circle back and ground it in Hill's testimony, but between what Dixon testified to extensively and the limits of what Hill testified to, which is that he heard gunshots and that you had the admission of shooting right afterwards when appellant returned to the car. There was no, he said he never saw appellant with the gun. He said he never saw appellant actually shoot. And he said repeatedly in the context of this pressure argument or this secret kind of secret deal argument that he was pressured to tell the truth, and he did feel pressure from the state to do that. So I think if you look at all of Hill's testimony together in the third trial, you know, when he actually did testify, I don't think, again, limiting or cabining it just to the interest of justice exception, you find any reason to conclude that Judge Cook abused his discretion in not applying that exception. I'm more than happy to entertain any other questions the panel still has.
Thank you.
Otherwise, I'd simply ask you to affirm the post-conviction order.
Thank you.
The court doesn't have any questions of me. I would just cede my time.
But I do have one question for you. I wanted to ask you with regard to the lack of information in the record about how Mr. Dixon testified in the first two trials and what inference, if any, we should draw from the fact that the juries did not reach a verdict in the first two trials. And so here's my question. It seems to me that you're arguing that we should conclude that based on the affidavit, there's clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Harris is innocent of the offenses for which he was convicted, so that you can make that newly discovered evidence exception around the time bar. But what I'm struggling with is, I would think the more accurate inference to draw from the lack of a verdict in the first two trials is simply that the jury didn't reach any unanimity as to whether or not Mr. Harris was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt or the state had not proven his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I'm not sure how much emphasis we should place on the hung juries when you kind of consider the standard of proof versus what your burden is here in going forward with an evidentiary hearing and the post-conviction petition. Can you address that?
I certainly understand I'm here with a high burden. I believe that in this unique setting where there are those two juries that are hung, followed by this jury that convicts, and you have multiple people all extraordinarily under the influence of drugs who are the primary testifying witnesses, I believe that the difference here would be that a jury would not convict and that there would not be a knowable perpetrator of the offense, which I believe is innocence. I believe that a jury could not be expected to know who committed this crime, and I believe that Mr. Harris is innocent of the offense.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would cede my time.
Thank you, counsel. We will issue a decision in the statutory time frame.